Hello and welcome to the Transmedia Podcast. This is me, Robert Pratton, and you can find me online on Twitter as Rob Pratton. And with me today, I've got two guests. I've got our own Belen Santoyalo, who's our Chief Creative Officer, and has a lot of experience with immersive theatre. And I also got me got with me Joris from the MAP Lab, the Media and Performance Laboratory. Hello, Joris.
Hi, pleased to meet you.
And hello, Belen, as well.
Hello.
I didn't wait for you to say hello. So, Joris, just explain a little bit about the MAP Lab. What you know, what its origins were, and what its goals are today.
Yeah. It has been a place for practice lab research at the HKU University of the Arts Utrecht, whereby we felt it was very important to create a space to facilitate innovations in using mixed reality technologies in the context of art education, design processes, and interdisciplinary work in general. So we build a bridge between art education and also professionals and the world of technological development, mostly through iterative design processes, doing tests, really combine like an embodied immersive learning principle to the notion of exploring new ways of making meaningful theatrical experiences. So as I said, it has been there for about three to four years. So we've done and gathered quite some interesting experience and data on how these environments can actually facilitate new forms of theatrical experiences.
Yeah, and I mean, we've been in contact for quite some time, but it was your document, The Mixed Reality and the Theatre of the Future, which really prompted me to get you on the call, because it seemed, although it's, I'm afraid to say, it's a year old already, it seems very timely and still very relevant. And if I may say, it was quite a page turner, because I looked at it and I thought, I'll just dip into this now and then schedule some time to read it later. And I couldn't put it down. So I just kept reading. Oh, this is great. This is great. I just kept going through it. And I think that's what gave me the sort of like momentum to get you on the call. So well done for that.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. And I think it's important to mention that it's free to download. And if you want to make a link on your podcast website, you're most welcome. I'm always very interested in what people feel about it, and it's especially written for makers and designers who want to explore new boundaries or new areas of theatrical experiences. So that's why I asked all the writers and all the artists who participated in writing about their projects to really share their knowledge on the process, including everything that went wrong, because many times we read about the end results, products, as some sort of success story, and we never learn from each other by sharing actually our mistakes. So that was one of the aims of the actual publication.
Maybe it's worth actually sort of defining, or at least talking a little bit about what you consider to be mixed reality and immersive theatre.
Yeah. Well, I tend in my lectures to always refer back to Milgram's virtuality continuum, because I think the term is sort of like a general term that encompasses many forms of mixes between technology-mediated experiences. So there, to me, it's not like Microsoft is now claiming it for particular hardware or software. That is very misleading, I think, for the understanding of the term. People are now replacing the term with XR, where X is for most people meaning either experiential or X of unknown. but I tend to see it in a more historical perspective, where indeed we're blending this imagined spaces with real spaces where the body resides already for a long time, hence the wonderful tradition of immersive theater. So I think it's not a very recent development. It has a long history in immersive theater already. And I think especially the technology and entertainment industry can learn a lot from this historic perspective.
So Belen, have you got anything to add to what Joris just said about about immersive theatre, would you?
Well, I've read and I know about that confusion about like mixed reality getting like replaced by that extended reality concept because of the brands just cannibalizing the term. And I think it's interesting. In the end, it's just playing and exploring and seeing what the technology can do and in creating immersive experiences or not immersive theater, because mixed reality is not a synonym with immersive theater. It doesn't have to be. So it always comes in the after review of what's been done that we start to name what that was. But I think that we're in a very incredible moment to explore and experiment what technology can do in the theatrical experience ground. So.
No, I agree. I think that maybe it's definitely not synonym of each other, immersive theater and mixed reality. I think mixed reality, when you need to define it, it's best to at least connect it to the idea of mediated experiences, meaning using technology as part of the experience, because otherwise everything becomes mixed reality anyway.
Yeah.
I think is what I see now really is whenever you mention the word immersive, a lot of people, their minds immediately jump to virtual reality, because they think the only way to get immersion is by going into sort of a synthetic world. Whereas a lot of the stuff that Belen and I work on is sort of virtual experiences in the real world without a synthetic, but using the technology to enhance or to do something with the real world. And that's where I think that's where my interest lies predominantly. And that's why I think the immersive theatre or the theatre of the future leads us to think that. But you have a lot of virtual reality examples in the report.
Yes, but I think one of the biggest, I would say, insights I got is that when VR was promised to break through in the early 90s, we still had this idea of cyberspace, meaning we would leave our bodies behind in cubicles or whatever and be gods in some sort of free mental world. And now I realized, and many people do, that actually VR is a very embodied experience. So it's very much linked to our bodies and to all sorts of systems within our body that perceive reality. So there's a very physiological aspect to this experience that is connected to the nature of the technology itself. And through that, automatically you're connected to the physical space in which you walk around, whether you see it or not. So I think VR is not as disembodied as we thought. It's actually the opposite, and that automatically opens up the necessity to design also the physical space in which this experience happens. And another thing to this is that you notice more and more, of course, even if you stay within the field of immersive VR, which is one end of the scale. I noticed that these sitting down experiences seem to completely neglect the fact that you're totally engaged with your body. So of course there are different types of VR. I mean the location-based VR setups that you now have in larger shopping malls and stuff is that really designed for you to run around physically inside of a virtual world. So you already see there some sort of crossover towards a mix of the physical and the virtual. And don't forget, I mean, when we talk about mixed reality, quite recently, I mean, since AR Core and AR Kit are out in public, and of course we were following Tango already for a long time, but these technologies are now available for everybody to use with their smartphone. So AR is now really booming, and the whole industry seems to instantly shift their focus to AR. And the moment they do that, you're exactly back to where you're operating, which is public space. So I think this is just temporary amnesia by both industry and the entertainment industry. But for sure, both through the technological nature of VR and also the tendency that we're now moving more towards an AR development points us back to the physical space and the central role of the physical body as the center part of the experience itself.
Yeah, that's a great point, Joyce. And I think you can see this You can see this in operation in just the simplest of experiments. For example, if you get like a 360 still photograph and of a place that you've been to, so you've got the memories of that place, you put on the virtual reality headset and you look around the space and there's something missing. And the first thing you notice that's missing is the sound. So just adding a little bit of Atmos really starts to make you feel much more present. And then, of course, you notice that you don't have the wind on your skin and just those. And I've just stood out on the balcony of my apartment, and already it feels much more like you're in that physical space. So it speaks to your point about, you know, we are still embodied, even if you can take your eyes to a different location and convince the visual senses that we're somewhere else. The rest of us knows it's still a lie.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that although, of course, the main public or the main target group is just people in their living rooms through some sort of entertainment context, and so they think about a traditional setup where you just sit on the couch or you're sitting behind your desk, I think when it comes to the full potential of the actual medium, you cannot but design the part where your body is really located in space and somehow engaged. And of course, for sure, if you look at what Leap Motion is doing and all sorts of other manufacturers, they're all trying to sort of incorporate visual representations of the body or through haptics to have some tactile feedbacks and things like that. But that's just the technology. I think it's much more interesting to, as designers and storytellers, to already think about this, like immersive theater is doing already for a long time.
Yeah, I think that it's related to this, but there was one point in your document that was really interesting, and you were mentioning a project in which there was like a little inconsistency between like the the physical input that you were getting and virtual experience. As like the perfect illusion is not necessarily the best artistic solution, and that reminded me of a project that we did in which we were using with the audience binaural sound mixed with head tracking. So the binaural sound was moving at the same time that the audience was moving. And the perception of the sound was so realistic that they even realized that that was happening. So they wouldn't realize that the sound was moving. So it was so faithful to reality that it didn't make an impact. It didn't make a change in the experience. And it was not worthy in the end. So can you think that this kind of mismatches is the way that creators should explore?
Yeah, for sure. I think you picked out one of the most important parts, I think, of the whole publication. And this is actually through the work of Crew, who is a Brussels-based mixed reality theater crazy inventor group led by artistic director Eric Joris. And they're already working with these media in theatrical context for a long time. And he definitely told me and showed me that for the experience to work, you need to sometimes have the perfect illusion and sometimes actually disconnect what you feel with your body and what you see and hear to keep somehow your brain aware of the here and now. Because when everything clicks perfectly, people tend to fall asleep because the brain is not in an alert state because everything is predictable. Another thing to this is that I think that from a dramaturgical point of view, so when looking at the idea of meaning, I think theater as a historic medium is already always dealing with these two realities at the same time, because even in a classical theater piece, even when you sit in the dark, you're still sitting next to somebody who is making sounds and coughing or whatever. You're in a room that has good acoustics or not. You're being badly placed, so you have to look around the person or whatever. So all these aspects are of influence and somehow conflicting experience of this willing suspension of disbelief to really immerse yourself in that theatrical world. Now, if you move in time to the growth of theater as a mature medium, so after post-dramatic tendency, so where they said we don't have to create an illusion, it's actually much more interesting to have these different layers of meaning or experiential meaning to somehow collide in meaningful ways you can actually, you have an additional dimension where you can actually tell a story. So when, I think, for example, Pipslop is another group that I mentioned in the articles. They did one piece where there are six people sitting with helmets on, and they hear each other in a by not having headphones, but just with the two national sounds. Then the voices of the characters that you're playing, you're sitting in a train coupe, and you, there's six people sitting there in two benches. So they recorded that, and the physical installation exactly the same. So you're sitting in the same position. And then you have a little speaker in front of your mouth. So your character in which you are sitting is actually talking from the position of your mouth. So you hear all the natural voices coming from the natural angles of your participants. But what is interesting, they also have a bone conducting speaker on your head. So while you're speaking certain sentences from your character, you hear him or her think at the same time by having the voice inside of your head. And of course, the moment where the character says one thing but thinks another thing, you have an interesting story to tell. That's where the conflict starts, where the, that's where the drama starts. And I think that is true for the technology as well. Sometimes it has to click, and sometimes it has to sort of collide for it to become meaningful. And there's so much we need to still explore about the nature of these technologies. We shouldn't hide it. It should be experience anyway.
So maybe that's a good moment to talk about the design process. Because one of the other things that you mentioned is that often with a technology, it might not be fully developed to the point where it fits snugly with a creative process. And so you've got the technologists wanting everything to be sort of like planned out ahead of time so they can get on with the development of it, because that's their design process. And you've got the creative sort of contingent wanting to actually sort of iterate on it a few times before they actually say exactly, because they don't know what they want yet, because they're going through a sort of exploration of the creative. So how can people join those two things together?
Yeah, and I'm aware that I'm in a very comfortable position of being in the educational and research field. So the degree in which we can experiment and things are allowed to break and go wrong and we can do it over is, of course, much there's more space for experiment in that area than if you do a production, especially a commercial one with your remote audiences that only are there for one moment. It has to work. So I'm aware there is a degree of freedom or a degree of experimental space within a commercial production is probably much smaller. However, I do feel that we're not entirely knowledgeable about the potential of these media. So I think a certain degree of experimentation and exploration should always remain within the project itself. I find experts who say I completely understand what VR is a bit suspicious, because I feel, you know, we still need a lot of work to do and build a lot of different types of experiences before we can sort of start to look back and say, you know, this is the true nature of the medium. So with and of course conductor is at the forefront of these developments as well. So I think that a certain degree of experimentation should always be part of your actual design process. Now, and then of course there's a lot of obvious statements I could make about iterative design and design cycles and testing with user groups and stuff like that. That is already inherent in these kind of productions that you're already probably doing as well. But I have noticed also at my laboratory that professionals coming from theater with very experimental questions and a large area of not knowing and wanting to find out actually turned immediately in the opposite direction the moment they felt the pressure of the actual production. So they would regress back in what they would know would work. And through that, we'd never get to the point where they actually explore the actual potential of the technologies that were offered. So it's always, I mean, you know, there's not the perfect way to go about it. You should at least maintain a certain degree of awareness about it, and maybe also educate your audiences that there's, you know, for them to witness this is also for them to become pioneers in this co-creative process. And that also means that you need to be aware that things might not work. You know, I don't understand why technology, you know, in theater, the essence of theater is that you never know if the performance will work out or not. That's what makes it live and interesting, and we'll all have a catharsis and applaud, you know, applaud the performance at the end because they actually made it to the end and they somehow managed to make it into a wonderful experience, right? Why is this not true of technology? Why, you know, technology will fail. It always does. So why is now suddenly the requirement for technology to be super stable, super predictable, always working, etc.? I don't understand that. But I understand it from an audience perspective. If that's their expectation, you have to live up to it. But it also means you cannot experiment and probably regress back to what you already know. So it's a little bit up to you, to the maker, and to I guess design the expectations a little bit within the actual experience for things to go wrong. And I mean, because it is theater or it's a theatrical experience, things that can go wrong can be part of the story, right? So if the technology is part of the content of your actual your story, it, you know, it's a fact of life that it also sometimes doesn't work. So you can always have like fail-safe scenarios dealing with those things. Did you? I mean, undoubtedly, Belen, you have.
I was going to say, yeah, Belen, you have a story there, you know.
Yeah, you probably have like a scenario B, C, and D. You know.
Totally.
That's how you design, of course.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that, as you said, that the audience expect everything to work okay, but they don't know what work okay is because they haven't seen the experience before. So you can work it so it feels like everything is progressing naturally when actually it's not, because something failed. And that's something I wanted to ask you about that tension between the performers and the technology, because that creates, I mean, obviously, two performers, you don't always have to rely on the other actor because maybe he forgets the lines or something happens or slips or whatever. They kind of are used to it. They are kind of react to if something wrong happens with another performer. But if something goes wrong with technology, most of actors are not trained for that, and that creates a lot of tension. Yeah, totally. So what would you recommend a creator? How can they deal with that?
Find the right actors. I was being slightly smart-ass by saying find the right actors, because in my experience is that some actors are great when it's scripted and they're terrible at improvising. And that, I mean, I don't do the working with theatre actors, you know, I've done working with screen actors, and the ones, a lot of people just can't improvise. That's the bottom line, I would say.
Well, that's one aspect of being flexible, so needing to deal with the situation that is different and changing all the time, especially when it becomes co-creative with your audience. You have to indeed have a certain type of actors that are properly trained to do so. You were already giving the answer, which is training. So it's not only about being trained in being improvisational. I always ask my performers to invest time to understand the technology itself to a certain degree, because I find it problematic if the actor expects the technology to always work perfectly. Their body, they have learned to really understand their bodies as a vehicle. If you're extending your body through technology, it means you need to discover those extra limbs by using them a lot and breaking them and falling with them before they become part of your body. So I always try to incorporate quite some time with the performers to work with the technology and also explain it to them, and sometimes even swap roles. So sometimes have them sit behind the computer and doing the configurations or doing the calibration becoming aware of the body of the technology as an extension of their own body and space. And it doesn't mean they have to learn how to program or understand all the nitty-gritties of the under the hood kind of technologies, but they need to have some degree of understanding what's going on. And I noticed that when it comes to improvisation, they can actually use that knowledge and have to use that knowledge when they need to improvise. So it's information they need to get, and it's also partly becoming acquainted with the technology as an extension of their own mode of expression, which is mostly through their body anyway.
That's a good point, actually, because you think, like, if let's say somebody had to get out of a car and they were stuck in the car, they would be familiar with the car space, they would be familiar with the different solutions to actually get out of the car, you know, or, you know, they had to put their shoulder in because maybe it's got stuck. And so they would be able to improvise around a car with a stuck door where they were supposed to get out of it. And it kind of talks to your point where you're saying if they don't know the technology, they don't really know how to think their way around it to get us back on track again. It's quite interesting. Yeah.
And the reverse is true as well. I've worked a lot with technological developers who had no understanding of the performing arts or a creative experience anyway. So I reversely also train them to become more aware of what we're trying to do from an artistic or aesthetical point of view by sometimes putting them in the shoes of designer or performer. Not because they're good performers, mostly they're not, but because they need to feel, also their awareness need to extend into the domain of where the performers are. So I think that dialogue, for it to become sensitive to each other, they both need to extend their world so it overlaps a little bit. So that's the place where they can meet. It's the place where they start to understand the other. And I have learned that investment in time in the longer term always pays off. Because if you have developers who don't understand the performing arts or an artistic process or a co-creative process with audiences, they're going to design tools and technologies that are simply not capable of responding to these interactions. So they need to first understand the nature of it for them to also sort of like anticipate what is needed, instead of finding out always afterwards and then, you know, the money runs out and you have no time to build a proper version.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I think it is that shared understanding where you get the best results, because often there's loads of things that the technology could possibly do, but maybe the technology person doesn't know how they could be used in the creative space. And then if you get the creative person that doesn't know the technology, of course they don't know how to get inspired because they don't know what the capabilities of the technology is. So often, you know, on our projects we would normally come together and, you know, we have different people from different backgrounds. We say, what about this? I want to achieve this. What, you know, try to come up with some blue sky thinking. And then the technologists might say, well, can't do exactly that, but what about this? Or that, you know, that reminds me of this. And it's through that conversation with people coming from different backgrounds that you get the, you know, rather than someone just throwing a spec over the wall and go, oh, can you do this for me?
Exactly.
I don't think that works. And the only, I think the only problem we run into, and I hate to say that it's normally graphic designers, where you want everybody to pull together as a team, and what you don't want is, because it is a collaborative effort, you don't want individual people to say, well, mine can only work if it's exactly like this, and they don't have any flexibility. Or what happens is when it comes time for delivery, that they actually forget about everyone else's interests and concerns and about the way it's supposed to work, and they just sit back and go, I've delivered my bit and it looks amazing. They go, yeah, but it's not practically, that's not going to work, you know. And we had that conversation. So I think you do need, it's about getting the right team players as well as getting them in the room together.
Yeah, and also understand I mean the nature of interdisciplinarity and not multidisciplinarity is that you have a genuine interest in the know-how of the other, which doesn't mean you need to know exactly how the other works, but you need to have some grasp on the language, the phasing, the outcomes, the what is considered to be a success kind of language. Because only from that shared language you can understand and attune to each other what is needed to have a successful intermedial or interdisciplinary production. I've never well, don't say never. It's the same for directors. If you have an artistic director who comes from a particular discipline, they have blind spots as well.
Yeah.
You know, if they come from film, they have blind spots to certain degrees of interactivity or liveness or embodiment. If they come from theater, it might be the same when it comes to interactivity. When they come from games, they think about performance as a rule set that needs to work. And if people follow the rules, it's a successful performance. While if theater people talk about this word, they mean completely the opposite, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot to this that is about wanting, first of all, understanding that what you're making is not a summary or a collection of disciplines together, but it's something new. So there's a domain that is unexplored, that is in between all the disciplines. So that means you have to create that in-between space, and for that you need a team of people who are actually asking those questions from their own discipline and are willing to open up and be interested in the other. I've done many labs where people say they were interested, and then we found out they weren't. Exactly what you're saying. They're actually interested in expanding their own profession, which is fine, but that is not the right, you know, the right team member for interdisciplinary, intermedial, or immersive theater or mixed reality experiences.
So I think that's a good point. I'd like to talk about the commercialization of the work, but I want to. Talking about those different points of view, Belen, your story about the research you did, talking to different groups of people, where they some would think it was escape room, and
yeah, well, we've developed some projects using design thinking methodology to craft the narrative of the theater piece. So we like to do like research, interviews, and we just clustered all the information that we gathered, and we started to create experience around the users that we wanted to reach. And sometimes when the production was on and we were in the exhibition of an immersive piece, we realized like how important the expectations were, what the past background of the audience members, the role of that in within the experience. For example, people were coming to an immersive theater piece and they found that it was happening in a hostel, and they found some keys that were props in the reception, and they thought that they had to take those keys and run across the whole place and trying to open all the doors, because you could see straight away that they've been in an escape room before, and they thought that that was the mechanic that was in place when it was not. So it's not only the experience that you design, but the past experience of the audience that really crafts their experience in what you're designing. Do you have any experience in that? Do you have that into account when you are designing your projects in the lab?
Well, my students do a lot of alternate reality gaming type of production, so I completely understand what you're saying. And even if you're like a super experienced producer of these kind of experiences for a long time, this is always what can and probably will happen. So I think managing, framing expectations is a very important part of the design. How do you invite people? How do they understand the rules of the magic circle that they're entering? This is not a game discussion we, thank God, are leaving behind. You're allowed to say these are the rules because you know it's not real, you know. So you can make a clear design point of view and say, you know, these are the boundaries in which we will have this shared experience. But even then, I mean, there can be so many things that we don't see anymore that suddenly for one person, for whatever reason, becomes very important. And I say that is both a design challenge, but it's also a design advantage, because I think if you do it well, a lot of coincidences, a lot of like high fidelity of the reality with all its details and coincidental circumstances can also work for you. So in public spaces, bystanders can suddenly become characters through some whatever behavior that they're just doing naturally that you can incorporate. So there's a lot that I think you need to summarize with this notion of control. So how much is it you wanna and need to control for people to behave within the boundaries of what you're designing, and at the same time sort of allow for a certain degree for coincidence to happen to deepen the experience also on a personal level, because completely tailor-made, individualized immersive theater pieces are way too expensive to produce. So you need to somehow have the environment also deliver its own details that by circumstance can just become part of the experience. But I think the keys are a very good example. Like you know, that became clearly as a prop way too important for those people and just messes up the whole experience. And I guess that is why sometimes you need to have, next to the system and next to the design, you just need people who can just jump in and sort of make sure that people are redirected in the right direction, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So, Joris, with the looking at the commercialization, is it like there aren't too many examples? Like Sleep No More might be one possible exception of theatre companies that manage to create immersive. And also, I would include Secret Cinema as well.
Sure.
Have like massive audiences for multiple running days. Why do you think there aren't more examples of that? Why aren't
in a commercial sense, you mean?
But yeah, why are there not like lots of commercial companies doing immersive?
Well, look at Disney parks.
Yeah. So you would class Disney as the whole like theme parks as immersive.
I'm not saying they're like layered, artistically interesting, dramaturgically challenging experiences. I mean, they're very flat. It is what it is, kind of make-believe stories. But it does. I mean, this whole industry of entertainment parks and immersive entertainment, which also has a long history. Have a lot of answers to how to negotiate and control rooms or people in rooms to behave in a certain way, how actually the waiting or the entering can already be part of the experiential design, how to create multiple perspectives and how to talk to everybody individually, why you cannot. I mean, there's a lot of questions we ask that you find in those entertainment parks. Of course, like I said, I mean, from an artistic point of view or from a like post-dramatic or dramaturgical point of view, I would say they're just way too flat, way too much all family, happy together kind of experiences. But I think that these location-based VR entertainment centers are a very interesting new addition to that, because that's clearly not for the happy family looking at, you know, Disney stories. But they can actually be quite disturbing experiences. And those platforms get cheaper and cheaper by the day. So I think more and more artists can actually start proposing creating alternative or fringe-like experiences in those centers. I mean, there's an audience for everything. So I'm sure those centers at some point will realize, like, how do we get more people in? And how can we move beyond the zombie shooter and, the army training? the effect adrenaline type of experiences, and move to things that are more meaningful. I mean, that's just a matter of time, and those questions will come. Like The Void is now having all these IPs with Marvel and stuff. So we already know what's going to happen for the next few years, which is just the same shit. It's the same Hollywood shit. But they will develop, meanwhile, the hardware, the software, the environments, their training their audiences how to sort of behave and like these kinds of things. So they're opening up these stages, as I call them, for artists to enter. And I think, yes, they're still now in a fringe Tribeca, you should have been there kind of exclusive experiences. And you know, it's all sold out and you have to read how everybody else was doing. but for sure, I mean, the environments and the infrastructure are becoming more and more open and nearby. So I think it's just also that it's just a matter of time. And I have to say that I don't know. I did a Void experience in New York of Ghostbusters, and it was very interesting to see how they thought of having 8 people going through that whole experience in 10 minutes, because they know they have to have a revenue of a certain amount of people per hour. There's a lot to the mechanics and the design of those mechanics in a very, actually, in terms of square meters, it's quite a small space, and they had quite this interesting experience that felt much larger. They're talking about crew and physiology design. They're worked out all sorts of redirective walking technologies to make sure that you think you go in a straight line, but you're actually walking circles. So in a virtual space, you're feeling you're going from one place to the other, having huge experiences, while you're actually just in a very small room. So there's a lot that is there that we can start making use of. And we don't have the money to develop all those things, so now we can make use of it. It's actually good. It's good news.
But do you think, as you mentioned, that like the intellectual property, it's key? Because that reminded me of like Pokemon Go making AR something mainstream, or like Secret Cinema with all the films that everyone knows and loves, and even Punch Drunk. They loosely base their plays into like well-known place. Is it to make something mainstream? Does it need to be to reach the audience through the content itself and not the format or the technology that they use?
Well, that depends on what your goal is. So if you have people who understand already the platforms but are sick and tired of the Marvel galaxy and they want to be in something meaningful, clearly then you don't need to convince them to go to the platform with a different kind of story. You need to tempt them with the story. However, if you use the word mainstream, we think that a lot of people are in VR, but actually they're not. I mean, you know, it's actually, in terms of media, still a fringe industry. And there's a lot of hype around it, but how many people actually do have VR helmets at home? It's not a lot. Yeah. So it's a matter of time to have these new generations grow up in these more like mixed reality experiences. And that's why it needs to infiltrate public space much more. That's why it's fine that also retail and whatever are using these technologies. Not that they're making interesting experiences, but at least the technology and the type of experience becomes more common to the general audience. So if you then make something with VR, you don't have to be afraid that everybody will fall over because it's the first time they put a helmet on, right? So there's a lot to this that indeed is just a matter of time. I don't think we're the forces that need to convince the mainstream that they should get to experience our stories. I think the industry is investing so incredible amount of money right now to get the mainstream in there. That's just a matter of time. We need to be prepared to have meaningful experiences with those platforms the moment the mainstream is ready for it.
I think that's a good goal for listen. You know, for a lot of listeners, I think to be ready when the audience wakes up and realizes they want something a bit more challenging or a bit more interesting. Yeah.
And I'm actually quite happy also with my students that we're still in this fringe-like area where we have already an audience that is partly educated, that is partly, like you said, has the right expectations, knows somehow a little bit the frameworks in which they know how to behave or not, what you can and cannot do. So we have time and space to experiment to the full extent of what these experiences can be, rather than needing to constantly be afraid that this one lady is not going to understand it while this other guy is already running around, etc., etc. So it's for us very important that we understand what is all involved. And to be honest, we have a lot to learn and explore still. We're not saying that we know fully what we're doing. So, you know, it's good that we have this time in this like fringe space to experiment and also make mistakes, you know. And hopefully the industry, and that would be also something, Robert, because you say, you know, there's less and less money available for these mixed reality experiences. I think if you frame it in the right language, you know, all these people moving into AR right now, there's going to be an abundance of money available because they're building mostly frameworks and platforms, but they're not building meaningful content. So, you know, right after all frameworks are established, they're going to scream for content. So there you are. You got enough work to do.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting. You could look at VR as kind of being slightly ahead of the curve, because I'm just so tired of first person shooting down spacecraft or something. Yeah. Because the games just aren't very. I'd sooner play a 2D game where they put more effort into the game mechanics and less into the. Because you play one and go, yeah, it's all right, and like my sister-in-law, who I would class as sort of like, quote, a normal person, not someone who's particularly into the arts or anything. She got the Samsung phone. I got her to get set up on VR. She played one experience, which was a good experience, but she never goes back to it again. So for her, it's not that amazing that she's not going to read a book, because that's what she normally spends her life in the evening reading books. But so VR is just not as exciting, or going to the movies for her. So it's quite interesting.
And there's another thing to this, which is of course the fact that we're group animals. So we don't like to be alone all the time. Especially when we have fantastic experiences, we want to share them at some point. So I think where theater is already a collective experience, and even watching a movie can be a collective experience, VR, for some reason, it's sometimes really weird having people sitting in rows with their helmets on, being in their solitary bubbles. So clearly, when it comes to the future of VR, it's about collective experiences, collaboration, sharing. The social aspect. And those frameworks are being built as we speak. And of course, when you have web VR or places like High Fidelity or things like that, maybe you should make a plugin or a connection between Conductor and High Fidelity. That would be very interesting, because you're connecting this social aspect to the web, to location-based experiences. And for sure, that's what people at some point want to do, for sure.
Exactly. I think we already have a plugin.
Good.
We're ready.
We're ready. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, we're so ready. So, Joris, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. It's been fantastic. It's been a really fascinating discussion. Is there anything that you would like to say that we've not had an opportunity to mention already?
Well, I would encourage people to have the bravery to share their mistakes and share their knowledge of what they've learned, and also in a commercial aspect, dare to do something experimental. Explain to the industry that this is the time to make a difference, to something new, and not repeat of what we already know, because then you better do it well in the medium that we know. So to have, I would say in proper Dutch, have some balls to really dare to experiment, and also inspire people who have the money for it or clients to say, you can be now at the forefront of this, but then please don't repeat what has already been done. So please have the balls to invest in something new, with the risk of it partly failing. But it will create a buzz one way or the other, because we're all now watching at these experiments anyway. So, from a PR perspective, you're going to be successful anyway, whether it's sales. let's.
I don't think I'm ever going to stand up and say that in front of a client, but I do like the. I do like the attitude.
I can easily say this, but I've been working in advertising for 7 years, so I understand how this works. And maybe not all clients are ready yet to dive into this. So you need to find the right clients also. It's not only about finding the right audiences. You also need to find the right clients to pay for this.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, it's really good. There are a lot of innovative companies out there, thankfully. So, like you say, it's just matching the right idea with the right client and the right creative, the right people to put it. It's the team always is a consideration. So, Joris, thank you very much. We'll include a link on the website to the report. Where can people find you if they'd like to get hold of you?
You can easily find me through... that's a problem. I don't have a private website. But if you read the IITM publication, you will see my name, and you just Google me. You will find me on LinkedIn, and you will find me on all sorts of websites with email and everything. So I'm sure it's...
Thank you very much. Belen, where can people find you?
Oh, people can find me online on Twitter at Belen_Santa and obviously at conductor.com.
Woohoo! Brilliant. Right. Thank you very much, guys. It's been fabulous. Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye. Thanks.